This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pancava. The suburbs are an easy target and frequent butt of ridicule. It's not uncommon to hear someone put them down for, say, having more than enough cul-de-sacs, but not enough culture. The thing is, people do move there and choose to live there, drawn in large part by the chance to own their own home. That home ownership, Joel Kotkin says, is a bigger draw than living downtown. As a result, Kotkin says, suburbs have grown and have changed the way we look at cities. Joel Kotkin spoke about the burbs and the evolution of cities in a speech at this summer's Aspen Ideas Festival. And it's that speech we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. The Aspen Ideas Festival is a week-long session of talks and conversations by politicians, business leaders, academics, artists, and entrepreneurs. Joel Kotkin follows and writes about global economic and political trends. His work has appeared in The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, The LA Times. His most recent book is The City, A Global History. As for his own history, Kotkin grew up in New York City, which he says is the image many people may still have when they hear talk of a city. But Kotkin says it's the place he lives in now, Los Angeles, and its sprawling suburbs that are the model for many other fast-growing cities. Here, then, Joel Kotkin speaking July 3rd at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado.
Cities are where humanity is going. This year, interestingly enough, I don't know if anyone has mentioned, it's the first year the majority of people in the world live in cities. That's really amazing when you think about it. In 1800, less than 2% of the people in the world lived in cities, and in 1900, 5% did. So in a little over a century, we went from 5% to over 50%. Now, most of those people live in the overcrowded, congested cities of the third world, and their urban dream is often a nightmare, although I think it is important to understand that for them, living in the city is still better than starving in the countryside. So, but that's where most of the population is. And so the question is, how do we create a better urban paradigm? And the way I'm going to start is to try to figure out how we do that in a way that's really more friendly, not just for the environment, but for those strange bipeds called humans, and how we can make a urban environment using new technology that is much more sustainable over time. Now, I'm going to focus mainly on what's happening in the West and in the United States. But I think what's happening here over time will be applicable to these other places, because one of the theses in the history of cities was that cities everywhere have more in common than are different about them, and that throughout history, they could all be similar. Like the book starts in Tenochtitlan, which is where Mexico City is. You know, when they made the subway in Mexico City, they ran into a lot of Tenochtitlan. And this diary of a Spanish soldier comes there. No contact with Spain, no contact with any civilization that he knew, and yet he could recognize in Tenochtitlan a city which had the things that he saw. It was sacred. It had a temple in the middle. It was safe. It had walls around it. And there was a huge marketplace, sacred, safe, and busy. So cities have certain things in common about them, no matter where they are. Now, if we translate this now into the 21st century, what we're going to see, I think, is an era in which individuals, families, businesses will have ever more freedom to locate where they want to live and how they want to live. In the process, you're going to see a lot of diverse environments. One of the things I say in the book I'm writing now about how America is going to be in, let's say, 2050, when we have 400 million people, and that's a reality. You could shut down the border tomorrow. The process is there. We're going to have another 100 million people, and how are we going to live with them? And I think what we're going to see is less and less about, is it going to be a dense urban future? Is it going to be a suburban future? Is it going to be an ex-urban future? And really, the answer is going to be more about and than or. When you have 100 million people, you're going to have to come up with lots of different kinds of environments. Now, what's going to drive this geographic diversity more than anything else are changes in transportation and telecommunications, which is going to allow for the spread of urban culture to the most remote parts of the of the nation, and I think over time to even the most remote parts of the world. So in this configuration, I think we're going to see something very different happening. You know, historically, most culture was formed in the largest possible cities. The bigger the city, the more important that city was. In the 21st century, what we're seeing now is that a small place can be very, very important and sometimes more important than a much larger place. And I just mentioned some places like, well, where we are right now, or Park City or Jackson Hole. There's probably more influential people, maybe more decisions steering capital in those small places than there are in many medium-sized or even larger cities. If you look in the developing world or in the new cities that have been built since the 1940s, you can see or have grown since the 1940s, a Singapore or a Tel Aviv is much more influential in the world than cities, let's say Cairo, 5 times, 10 times as large. So what I want to do is give you an idea about this process of diffusion that's taken place and then explain how it happened, starting with the movement to suburbia, second to the movement of the multipolar cities, and then to exurbia, and finally to a place like Aspen, which can, in a sense, even though it's in the countryside, is actually really part of this global city. This represents a radical shift in how we should think about things, because it really tells us something very, very different. Historically speaking, the city was where all art, culture, ideas took place and where they were discussed. There was no Aspen Ideas Festival in ancient Greece. This took place in the Agora, in the marketplace. In contrast, the periphery, the countryside, was the domain of localism, kinship, families, folk religion, superstition. Karl Marx talked about the idiocy of rural life. Nothing interesting happened in the countryside. In contrast, it was the city where everything interesting happened. Socrates expressed this sensibility when he remarked, "The country places and trees don't teach me anything, and the people in the city do." So there was this very strong sense, and that sense really existed in almost all cities and almost all societies into the 17th and 18th century. The countryside might be a convenient place to go to escape from the city, but it wasn't where things happened. It wasn't where ideas were. It wasn't where culture was. It wasn't where decisions were made. And that was true of Tenochtitlan or Rome or Constantinople or Baghdad or Cairo or Kaifeng or Beijing or Tokyo. The city was where all the action was. This process, I believe, reached its apex with the Industrial Revolution in Britain, the first country where the majority of people actually lived in cities. What the Industrial Revolution did is it changed the nature of how cities were built and how big they could become. The technology of railroads, the technology of the telegraph changed everything. So really, you can almost take urban history and say, it really is a tremendous continuity all the way up to about 1800, and then it radically changes. Now, what changed was amazing productivity. De Tocqueville talks about going to England in the 1830s, and he said, everywhere I turned, there were things that would make a tourist's heart leap. These bridges, these steel bridges, and the infrastructure of the Industrial Revolution. But there was another side of it, and I think this is where we began to see the move towards dispersion, and that is, you can see it today, if you go to Mexico City or Bombay, the kind of misery that the industrial city created. Frederick Engels wrote about this. I always make my students read the Condition of the Working Class in England, because it's one of the great books of urban history, and the world that he describes is really horrific. There were amazing health problems. Historically, cities have had higher death rates in the countryside, but they went to a tremendous extreme in the 19th century. The differences, the tremendous diseases that were in these places were amazing. Then there was a social dislocation, the treatment of young children in the Industrial Revolution. So what we saw was this terrible wrenching of the human spirit. And I think this is basically where we begin to see something change in the nature of cities. One of the things is that historically the elites always lived close in the city. And actually, as we still see in an odd way today, and certainly in many European and Latin American cities, the very elite lives in the center. This began the change in the Industrial Revolution, because, you know, who wants to live next to a toxic place? So what we started to see for the first time is the city was seen as a place to make money, but not where you would spend your leisure, not where you would socialize. So what you found was that the owners of the factories, as quickly as they could, moved out of the cities where they were making their money, and they moved to the countryside. They found the daughters of feckless aristocrats and moved to a big estate, and then they got on Masterpiece Theater and became very sensitive. You always wonder about these people who are living this tremendous wealth. They never work. You ever notice this? You know, none of these people ever work, and they could really worry about being sensitive. But meanwhile, they're the ones who are indirectly sending the 9-year-olds to work 12 hours in the factory. Now, the middle class didn't have that option. They had to run the factories. They had to be near the train stations, near the telegraph. So they started to do what made sense. They moved upwind from the stench, and they started the first suburbs. And the beginning of suburbia, as we know it today, the idea that the middle class would move out of the inner city started with the Industrial Revolution. In the past, by the way, suburbs were seen as kind of de classe, where the poorer people went because they couldn't afford to live close to the center. And, of course, the people who really suffered were the working class. And the working class was stuck in these places for a very long time. But over time, through their own political struggles and in alliance and sometimes with the middle class, they began to say, there's got to be a better way. And in England, which really was the crucible of all these new ideas, they began to think about, maybe we shouldn't put people in the cities so densely. The cities of the industrial era were about 3 to 5 times denser than medieval cities because you had people living on top of each other in a way that you'd never seen before. And the British thinking became, maybe we should try something else. Maybe we should move people out of the city and give them a chance to live in a different way in what Ebenezer Howard called garden cities. He suggested self-contained towns of maybe 30,000. They'd have their own employment-based neighborhoods of pleasant cottages and be surrounded by rural areas. Howard wrote, town and country must be married, and out of this joyous union will spring a new hope, a new life, a new civilization. And this is really where we begin to see this great movement to suburbia. Interestingly enough, the beginnings of suburbia are not seen as a reactionary step. They were endorsed by H.G. Wells, by Frederick Engels, by Thomas Carlyle. They were seen as an enlightened way of reacting to the problems of the industrial era. So this obviously came very popular in the United States. The United States was particularly well-suited for suburbanization. For one thing, it had a lot more land than England. And America has a great ethos about owning property, and the opportunity to own property was very important. So even as America became more urbanized, the desire for something else, a connection to the countryside, a place to buy, where you could buy a home, became greater and greater. So basically Americans began to look for something different. And I was asked, when you want to see why that happened, you can go, if you're in New York City, I would suggest you go to the Tenement Museum in New York City. I took my oldest daughter there recently, and you're really in maybe 400, 500 square feet, a family of 4, 5, 6 people, and very often living and working. She was amazed that that's how people lived. You know, our ideas today, we read Jane Jacobs, oh, these dense urban neighborhoods, they were great. Everybody looked out for everyone. They were really wonderful. Well, I took my daughter to a greater authority, my mother. And my mother grew up in a place called Brownsville. I won't use her colorful language exactly, but she said it was a crummy neighborhood then and it's a crummy neighborhood now. How did people live in Brownsville? So I had my daughter talk to her about it. Oh, well, they lived in a 2-bedroom place with 5 children, 2 parents. And, of course, the only wildlife they saw was what you didn't want to see. And so for my mother and for almost my entire family, and I think this is basically what happened in many American cities, the idea was, let's move further out. Now, in some cases, that move was further out in Brooklyn or into Queens. In other places, it was to move even further. But the idea was to get house a little bit of space, a little bit of territory of your own, a little bit of privacy. What happened was first people would go to where they could walk. Then they started having transit, and people went out there. And then, of course, you had automobiles. So what happened was once people had this choice, they moved to the suburb. Now, there are postmodernist historians will tell you, well, that they were brainwashed into the suburbs. They really did want to live in those, you know, two-room apartments with five kids. I don't think that's what happened. I think people moved to the suburbs. A, the government made it more possible for them to do it, that's for sure. But that's where they wanted to go, and it made sense for them to go. So if you look at the 1950s, about 84% of all population growth took place in the suburbs. Now, many say, well, you know, the suburbs, they're stupefied. They're culturally barren. They're the home of racists. They've been claimed for the decline of, I mean, I love these. Sometimes the new urbanists really make me, you know, they're really funny sometimes. They say, well, they're responsible for the decline of the inner city, as if people had to be locked in conditions they didn't want to live. Or they're responsible for the widening of people's waistlines. They're the cause of peak oil. They brought us into Iraq. Basically, anything bad is ascribed to the suburbs. But I think we should look at it in a different way. It was really something that was, I think the essayist D.J. Waldie put it best, it was a rough communitarianism backed by economic prosperity. You know, there are many things wrong with suburbs, and I'll talk about those and how we can correct some of them. But we have to understand something. We created the first mass middle class in the history of the world where people actually owned their own land and owned their own home.
A Case for Suburbia, given by Joel Kotkin, author of The City, A Global History. He spoke at the Aspen Ideas Festival this summer. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
In 1940, 45% of Americans owned their own home. In 2005, it was approaching 70%. If there's anything basic to the American experience and to American success, it's been this. Now, is this coming to an end? Well, I think the process is continuing. In 1920, 20% of the population lived in the 30 densest counties in the country. Today, about 11% do. In the first half of the 2000s, nearly 90% of all growth in metropolitan areas took place on the periphery. So if you take a population increase in our 54 largest metropolitan areas of about 10 million over the past 5 years, suburbs and exurbs accounted for all but 821,000, slightly over 92%. So basically what we've continued is this trend. Despite everything you read in the newspaper about empty nesters moving back into the city and all the real estate speculation, the growth has been in the suburbs and the growth has been both inner ring suburbs and particularly outer ring suburbs. Now, why is this happening? I think the biggest reason is, again, what one historian called the universal aspiration. And it's interesting, the same trends are happening in places like Japan and Western Europe, where there's great transit systems, where gasoline costs $6 $6 a gallon. Despite all those things, and even where they don't have much population growth, you continue to have this movement. There is something in the human spirit, and particularly the American spirit, that wants to live in some degree of privacy and some space of their own. The United States, this process is greatly accelerated by the fact that our population is growing much faster than virtually every advanced industrial country and actually is beginning to grow faster than China's. Why is that happening? Well, that's a really, interesting question. A friend of mine, a demographer, Bill Fry, was in Japan recently, and they said to him, well, Bill, we don't understand. How does your population grow faster than ours? And Bill said, well, if you have to ask that question, you've got more problems than I think. Fundamentally, Americans are, procreating more than other people, in part, I think, because we have more space, part because of immigration, in part because of a kind of essential optimism. So what we're seeing now is a creation of cities that are different than other cities. They are more suburban. They spread into larger and larger areas. What we're seeing is a very serious change in how cities look. The conventional view is a city is New York City or Chicago. It's got a core. and then neighborhoods outside of it, and then neighborhoods further out. But everything runs around that core. We are really living in an era where the vast majority of the urban growth in America takes place in completely different kinds of cities. We're not creating more New Yorks and Chicagos. We're creating more Los Angeleses. As much as you might hate them, that's what's happening. L.A. is the original of the Xerox machine. All the growth in America looks more like L.A. than New York. The amount of growth that's taking place in gentrified urban cores is so small as a percentage as to be relatively insignificant from an economic point of view. Like the suburbs, most urbanists don't like these kinds of cities. Los Angeles has always been hated. Shelby, my former editor of the L.A. Times, knows about how unpopular L.A. is. In the 1930s, it was called the anti-city, or 19 suburbs in search of a metropolis. Less a city than a perpetual convention. Aldous Huxley called it the city of dreadful joy. Now, I think these views are short-sighted. Just as the industrial city was different than the classical Renaissance city, the city of today, the L.A., the Phoenix, even to some extent the Denver, is different, fundamentally different, because it was born in a completely different era, an era of air transport, an era of the automobile, and now the era of the Internet. So it's a completely different kind of thing. Now, what's very interesting about it is this new city is basically a multipolar city. In other words, you take downtown Los Angeles. It employs maybe 4% of the people in the L.A. area, whereas Manhattan employs 50% of the people in New York. Almost all growing American cities have between 5 and 10% of their employment in their urban cores. So we're seeing something very, very different. Now, I would think that what's interesting about these cities is, although they are more spread out, they are following a pattern that predates the Industrial Revolution. If you look at the great cities of the past, if you go to London, Paris, Tokyo, there is no downtown London, downtown Paris, downtown Tokyo. There are a series of different poles, some of which have different functions. One area might be for books, another area might be for finance, another area might be for government, another area might be a religious center. They're not all in one area. In fact, the notion of downtown, this idea that we can create a downtown and we'll put choo-choo trains into it, and that's how everybody will live and everything will be determined by how far we are from the center, is actually a fairly new concept. The first mention of the word downtown was 1836. It was not in common usage to the early 1900s. So what we're seeing is not a break with urbanism, but in some ways a return in a different form to the way cities had been formed before, that is multipolar with many different places. Now, where are we going with these multipolar cities? And this, I think, was perhaps one of the great ways that cities will grow in the future. If you take a Houston, a Phoenix, a Los Angeles, what you're seeing now is a densification process, not going all to the downtown, but lots of different centers. Even like if you go to a place like Irvine, I was working on a project where they were starting to build some higher density housing in Irvine. It's actually doing quite well. What you're seeing is new housing in, let's say, the inner rings of Houston, in the Third Ward, an African-American area, new kinds of urban growth. They're not urban growth the way we have seen it in the past. The new kind of urban growth is diverse, protean. It doesn't follow the traditional urban hierarchy. The prevailing characteristic is their diversity and the range of functions. One of the great things about it, if you go to a city like Houston, is the way that ethnic groups are able to express themselves in a way that's very, very different in terms of building business centers, multipolar business centers. There's the area called the Harwin Corridor, which is kind of a auto-reliant Casbah run predominantly by Asian import-export companies. There are districts that are run by people from Vietnam or India or Latin America. So what you're seeing is this new kind of constellation of relatively dense nodes in these urban areas. And I think over time, what you're going to see is a whole new kind of urban life, totally different than what our ideas of urban life. Look, I love New York. I'm a native of New York. I like visiting it. But the model that's developed in New York, San Francisco, Chicago, is not going to be able to accommodate even those part of the population, about 10 to 15 million, who are going to want to live in cities out of the 100 million that are going to be coming online. So I think that the urban growth is going to be in the Phoenix and Houston and places like that, and it's going to have this very, very different form. Now, the other thing that I think is going to happen is that most of the growth outside of these cities will take place in mainly the areas that are on the outskirts of all the big cities, but particularly in the Sun Belt. Now, why is that happening? And I'll just give you a few reasons why that's going to continue to happen. One is, you know what? Most people like the suburbs. I've looked at every survey I could get my hands on specifically looking at cities. I've looked at Kansas City, Los Angeles, Dayton, Philadelphia. And in every case, people who lived in the suburbs felt better about their communities than the people who lived in the city. It just seems to be the case.
Joel Kotkin, speaking in July at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Colorado about how cities and the humans in them have evolved. Kotkin is author of The City, A Global History. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Another big factor is single-family houses. About 80%, most surveys will show, want to live in a city. But they want to live in a single-family house. So if they live in the city, if they can do it and have a single-family house, they're going to go for it. If they have to move to the suburb, they will. So a lot of times people say, well, you know, that people would like to walk to things, and that's true. But will they give up a single-family house and live in a small condo so they can walk to things? Probably not. But the two things I want to focus on right now and understanding these trends are the two big demographic forces. One is aging boomers. The second one is immigrants and minorities. In 2015, nearly one in three children in America will be an immigrant or the child of an immigrant. The total percentage of immigrant households in America has now reached about 15%. It's going to go way over that. One thing is because immigrants are having children. What's interesting, when you look at the surveys of what immigrants want, you know, some of us second, third, fourth generation people might have disdain for suburbs. Immigrants love them. If you want to see the real growth of suburbs in America today, you got to look at what's going on with immigrants, Vietnamese, Chinese, Hispanics. If you go into Southern California, the movement out towards the San Gabriel Valley and what we call the Inland Empire, very heavily driven by immigrants today. In the Washington, D.C. area, about 87% of all foreign immigrants live outside the District of Columbia. So what you're seeing is immigrants are voting with their feet, and they're voting for the suburbs. Now, that means the suburbs are going to be very, very different places. Increasingly, in most regions in this country, if you want to find a good Indian restaurant or Chinese restaurant, you're not going to find it in the inner city. You're going to find it in the suburbs. If you want to take a look at a friend of mine took me recently out in Fort Bend County, out in the outer reaches of Houston, and that's saying something. And he took me to a huge new Hindu temple which had been assembled piece by piece from India into this very distant suburb of Houston. Virtually all the growth in the middle class for the among immigrants is taking place in the suburbs. So I think that's really where it's happening. The other thing what we're seeing increasingly is the African-American population, those who are making it into the middle class, they're also moving into the suburbs. Between 1980 and 1994, the percentage of African-Americans living in the periphery grew by over 50%, and now is more than one out of every three. So when you think about America in 2050, and you think about where am I going to see this amazing, diverse country, in many ways, you're not going to see it in the urban glamour zones of Manhattan and San Francisco. San Francisco, by the way, is losing African-American population. Its working-class Asian population, middle-class Asian population, is also moving out. Its Hispanic population, again, those who don't have lots of money, they're moving out. In many ways, the inner parts of the cities that are recovering are actually less diverse than the suburbs that are around them. The other big source of growth is going to be the aging boomers. One of the great drinks of Kool-Aid that are taken by real estate developers is, well, you know, they're all going to sell their home in the suburbs and they're going to move to the city. Brookings has just done a study. Every study I've done, every study I've looked at shows most boomers are not going to move to the inner city. Why? First of all, the nice ones, the few ones that exist, are very expensive. Most of the boomers have lived in the suburbs all their lives. They're not likely to want to live in a denser environment. They also They have a house that they've paid for. Are they going to spend a lot of money to live in a very, very expensive place and take on a lot of more debt? Another big thing is what happens when we age. And I hate to talk about this in personal terms, but it's sad to say. You know, you slow down a little bit. All those hip, cool bars and stuff don't mean as much when you're 55 as when you're 25. I'm sorry. I think that's pretty much the case. I mean, I know there are always those guys in L.A. with ponytails driving around in Porsche, so I guess. But the reality is that people, as they age, they want to slow things down a little bit. What are the two biggest activities that grow as we get older? Gardening and bird watching. I don't think you're going to do that in a condo. So the fact of the matter is most boomers are going to stay pretty much where they are. Also, many of them are going to continue to work. It's also where their churches are. It's also where their children are. And so I think if we look over time, we're going to see that the boomers are going to continue to stay in the suburbs, and they're going to be a big factor as in creating more and more opportunities, I think, for companies in that area. Now, if the boomers go anywhere, they're going to go further out. And that's almost everything we see happening. And I think what's going on is you're seeing a lot of migration away from the suburbs and cities beginning to move to the countryside. Now, if I'm going to take a wild-ass prediction, which I can't totally support like everything else, I think there will be continued movement into the countryside. We do see a lot of movement of basically two groups. One, the empty nester, baby boomer types, sometimes moving home to take care of elderly parents, sometimes because they want to slow down their lives, sometimes because they're equity refugees. In other words, they sell a house in Silicon Valley that's worth $1.2 million. They buy a place in St. George, Utah for $400,000, and they live on the difference. There are lots of reasons why this is happening. The other group seems to be about age 30, 35. People are also beginning to see living in these new places. This is going to change the nature of urbanism again. I think what you're going to see over time is this continued movement of people into smaller towns. I think baby boomers in particular, who dominate the media, don't understand the cost problems for young couples trying to buy a house, trying to get a start. And the countryside, I think, is going to be very, very attractive to them. And as they move to the countryside will become more urbanized. Same thing with the baby boomers. Baby boomers moving to places in the Rocky Mountains, in the Appalachian Trail, in all these other places, the Ozarks. They're going to change the nature of those places. And you're starting to see urban sophistication connected by the internet in these places. Again, you have to understand the importance of the internet in all this. When I used to start going to these small towns 10, 15 years ago, you couldn't get the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, or it came 3-4 days late. Today, you can sit in Fargo, North Dakota, and have the same information as somebody working in Manhattan or downtown Chicago. So there's really been a fantastic change that's going on. And I think this means not the end of cities, but a change in the nature of cities and what we consider a city. So as we think about this next 100 million Americans, I want to think about a future that will work for families and for the middle class. And I think that future is going to be a new, what I would call an urban archipelago. It will have the traditional city. It will have the multipolar city. It will have the suburbs, the exurbs, and increasingly the countryside. Now, I think what's going to happen to some of our cities, and I'm thinking particularly certainly Manhattan, San Francisco, Boston, is they are probably going to continue to bifurcate. In other words, they are much too expensive for the vast majority of people to live in. I was interviewing a developer in New York, and we're doing the study of the middle class. He said, well, you know, we're really spending all our time in Brooklyn and Queens because, you know, really, the middle class in Manhattan is just not going to have much of a future. And he said, what do you mean? My friend's son just moved to Manhattan, and they're middle class. And I said, yeah. And he said, yeah. He just bought an apartment here. And he said, oh, yeah? I said, how much did you spend? He said, oh, $1.2 million, and his father bought it for him. I said, you know what, if your father can buy you a $1.2 million apartment, you're not middle class. Those are the perceptions. But I think what you're going to see is these places becoming very expensive and in many ways very bifurcated with a population that services this very wealthy population As a friend of mine said about San Francisco, it's become a cross between Carmel and Calcutta. I think there's going to be some truth to that. Now, I just want to say briefly, I don't think this is the way it has to be. I think if cities attach the basics, good parks, schools, neighborhoods, they could retain some of this middle class. But frankly, I'm not sure most of the mayors are going to be serious about it. Easier to get a Starkitect museum built and have a block of jazz clubs and say, I turned the city around, than have to do the hard work that most mayors don't want to do. But even if they do it right, most of the growth in the future will not take place in the urban core. It will take place in these communities that I've been talking about, whether they're in the countryside, the exurbs, or the suburbs. Now, what I think will be happening is these places will become more and more like cities. In other words, they will begin to have centers. You see a lot of even malls being transformed into sort of urban lifestyle centers, or they're building housing around them. You have many of these small towns that became suburbs now redoing their downtowns to give them a sense of identity. A great example is Naperville, Illinois, for instance, is one of the places that's done it. Fullerton, California, where the what used to be just pure suburb that surrounded a kind of funky old downtown that nobody liked, now that downtown has become the urban core for a surrounding, basically suburban village, part of that archipelago. Some cases, they're building the villages from scratch, like in the Woodlands outside of Houston. Now, a lot of people say, well, this is inauthentic. This isn't the traditional city. Jane Jacobs wouldn't like it. But, you know, as a friend of mine, an architecture critic, said, you know, European visitors came to New York and they went to Chicago and they went to Cincinnati in the 19th century. They thought American cities were pretty damn ugly, too. And they didn't understand what was happening either. So what I'd like to do is leave you with the idea of let's try to imagine what this future is going to look like with this 100 million more people. And I think what we're going to see is a spread of urban culture like we've never seen before. You can see it, for instance, in the growth of regional theater. There have been about 335 regional theaters developed in the last 10 to 20 years. There are all sorts of new cultural institutions being built, whether it's at Strathmore in northern Bethesda or Cobb County or Orange County, California. And these places are now in many ways competitors with traditional urban centers in terms of culture. And I think even more important is the movement of what I would call the sacred space of churches. I've been following the movement of churches trying to understand how a city is doing. And one of the first things when I'm sort of trying to understand the city is how are your local Catholic churches doing? Are they expanding or are they contracting? If the Catholic Church is expanding, that city is generally healthy because they're creating Catholic schools, which are one of the tools of upward mobility and part of the social network. What we're seeing increasingly is the Catholic churches, the mega churches, the mosques, the synagogues, because I mentioned the Hindu temple, the small Christian churches, and particularly the African-American ones now moving to the suburbs, and that becoming a new part of what knits that community together. So what we're not seeing is the end of urbanism, the death of urbanism, because I've been attacked for saying these things as being anti-city. I think it's a new kind of urbanism, an urbanism that's spreading into more and more and more places as these places begin to become more interesting places to live. Finally, I want to talk about what this means for families and what I really see happening over the next 20 or 30 years. And I think what you're going to see is suburbs and exurbs beginning to develop as job centers even more than they are now and becoming places that people actually consider their city. I think you're going to see more and more people not commuting from the suburbs to the city. I think the bedroom suburb is going to be out of fashion in 10 to 20 years. First of all, the tremendous numbers of people who are working at home. It's growing very rapidly today. If you take out New York City, there are now more telecommuters than there are people who take mass transit. I was talking the other day with Gene Dupre at IBM Consulting. Over 70% of the 86,000 people who work for IBM Consulting work at home. Many of the most progressive companies are doing this. I think in the future, if you try to attract young talent, they're going to ask you, why am I commuting an hour to go from one computer screen to another? It makes absolutely no sense. Now, this is going to change everything. And what I see is people living closer to where they work or working at home, having the distance between work and life begin to break down. And this is, in many ways, reminiscent of what we had before the Industrial Revolution. So one of my principles is the post-industrial society looks much more like the pre-industrial society than we would have ever expected. And I think that we're going to see an enormous possibility for a new kind of urban life. Finally, I just want to talk a little bit about, because one of the people say, well, what about global warming, blah, blah, blah? What are we going to do about energy? And should we change and live in denser spaces? This is one of the big principles new urbanists will now use, because I guess peak oil didn't work, and I guess people's waistlines didn't work either. Well, I think if we think about the environment, we should begin to understand that high-density development creates what's called heat islands. They actually are not necessarily very environmentally friendly. What I see happening is an archipelago, what somebody calls smart sprawl, that goes over a large amount of space, but nevertheless has a lot of green space in between, using basically lower density housing, which, by the way, also tends to use less energy and less water than the denser areas. One thing you don't want to do, by the way, is do what the city of L.A. did, build in the middle of a real heat island, to build a Frank Gehry building with a reflecting metal roof. I saw one in Phoenix the other day. I couldn't believe how much light was being brought back. So I think what we're thinking about is really a new kind of urban future here in the United States. And I think that we can start to see this urban archipelago with people working at home or close to the home with lots of green space in between as being a really human solution to the century of in which the majority of people live in cities. I really see an enormous potential in this. Finally, I just want to say, well, what does this mean long-term to the rest of the world? The rest of the world isn't America, obviously. And so I've been looking at cities around the world and with some work with a client who's doing a lot of work in the Middle East. And I think that what we need to see is that trying to take the industrial age model of Western urbanism and putting it in the third world is probably not that good an idea. It's very energy consumptive. It tends to create tremendous concentrations of wealth and poverty. It makes it very difficult to get to work, even has an effect on birth rates. If you go to a place like Seoul, Korea, which is one of the most dense, concentrated cities, everything that you know urbanists would like, you know, 40-story high-rises everywhere. They have now one of the lowest birth rates in the world. So I went to a Buddhist seminary. I asked him, well, why is this the case? He said, well, if you have to wait till you're 40 to buy 400 square feet, and then you have to get on a train to go to Seoul out of your 400-square-foot apartment, you're too tired to have children. And I think that this is one of the things we're creating. We're creating things that look great, that architects like to build, you know, like they like to play with these giant erector sets. And we're not thinking about how human beings really need to live, how they want to live. And I think what we need to do in the developing world is begin to create a more dispersed kind of existence. And I think it's beginning to happen. Recent surveys are showing that in the megacities like Buenos Aires, Calcutta, Mexico City, have actually more people leaving than coming. I think if you look in Mexico, you want to feel good about Mexico, you go to some of the smaller, better-run cities because those are places where life is much more worth living. As one person said, Mexico City's bloat has robbed it of its economic logic. People are looking for different environments. They are looking for smaller cities that can run more efficiently as opposed to these mega cities. Again, Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, Tel Aviv work much better than Cairo, Bangkok, Jakarta, and Manila, which are much larger. I think people are beginning to look at the question of decentralization and dispersion as something that works. There is an enormous appeal to this model for people. I mean, of course, all you have to do is go to the San Gabriel Valley in Southern California and see how many people from Taiwan are living in single-family houses in what you might call sprawl. People are looking for a different way of life. I'm not necessarily sure that putting people, particularly families, in high-rise buildings is going to work over time. I don't think it's socially sustainable. And I think there are questions about its environment. So ultimately, I just want to suggest a whole bunch of ideas which are probably completely contradictory to everything else you've heard about cities, but at least I can get you to think a little bit about it. And I think these issues are going to be very important because we live in an age of global cities. We live in an age in which the city is the center of the global society. And I think it's time for us to think very seriously of alternatives of how to make that global majority live a better life, not just here in America, but everywhere. Thank you.
A speech from this summer's Aspen Ideas Festival in which Joel Kotkin explains the evolution of the city and defends the suburbs. Kotkin is author of The City, A Global History, and The New Geography. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After his speech, Joel Kotkin took questions from the audience.
What are the implications for the nation politically
of
this dispersion? And what will it mean for our political priorities and social priorities?
Well, I think there's going to be two things happening. One, the cities are going to continue to, the traditional cities will lose political power, as has been happening. But the suburbs, as they become more urban, will also become less conservative. They will have to deal with the problems of having a large elderly population and what those people need. They're going to have more minorities, and they're going to have different sensibilities. Remember, 95% of suburbanites in 1970 were white. Today, it's probably somewhere around 70%. In 2050, it may be 55 to 60%. So as cities will continue to decline in relative numbers, suburbs will become more diverse. And one hope is that we may get more solid middle-of-the-road politics out of it.
Hi, my name is Chuck Belloc. In the Front Range of Colorado, particularly around Denver, we're seeing the rise of TODs, transit-oriented development, right, which is another name for medium-density yuppie towns, and some empty nesters mixed in as well. And this phenomenon seems to be gaining in popularity, but particularly amongst 20 and 30-somethings who I'm not sure have really formed families yet but are just starting out. Is this just an economic model that works for that age group, which will then transfer their interests further out into typical suburban and exurban communities, or do you think this has staying power?
Well, the interesting thing about transit-oriented development is there's been quite a few studies which are showing that a lot of those people don't take transit. One of the reasons they developed is they get tax breaks for being where they are. One of the things we're finding in Los Angeles is they're building transit-oriented developments, but they're much too expensive for the people who take transit. So it really doesn't do that much good. I mean, I think a lot of this money being spent on light rail would be better spent on the bus system, particularly the rapid bus system. We have to look at the fact that I think in Denver, light rail, the last numbers I saw, it was about 20 times as many people telecommute as take the light rail. I think this is a great real estate speculation. I was in Phoenix recently, and they said, oh, we're developing light rail. And I said, what's the purpose of that? Oh, it's good for real estate. I mean, it's really not necessarily the way people are going to live. I'm not necessarily against it, but I think what happens is they're trying to create areas where they can put more density, and the light rail is an excuse. But I think your observation is very true. What you're going to see is it's going to be the young people who have not formed families yet who are going to move into these places more than anyone else. And I think that is the group that's most attracted also to urban areas. You have a person, let's say, they're working for a high-tech company in the northern part of the Front Range. They're not ready to buy a house. They really want to, maybe they're traveling a great deal. And these kinds of developments are attractive to them. But I'll bet you if you went into those apartments, because we just saw a study in L.A., about 90, 95% of those people are driving to work.
Joel, that was a great talk. I was very interested in your comments on telecommuting. That having been one of the things that even 20 or 25 years ago was always in the futurist predictions. And then it turned out, well, there's a social function to work that people wanted. Now, perhaps with the internet and ever faster bandwidth, they're making more progress. I just wondered if in either talking with the IBM person or others, you've seen how the social function that 20 or 25 years ago was seen as holding back a massive growth in telecommuting is either being substituted for or is it dying away?
Well, I think obviously there are certain things where you're going to have some social functions, but Shelby, you know, you were in L.A. The entertainment industry is dominated by individual proprietors who work out of their homes. I mean, I live in a neighborhood which is very close to Universal Studios and Disney. There is no rush hour in my neighborhood. I mean, there's a rush hour on the freeway, but I ride my bicycle at 9 o'clock, and, you know, it's like riding the bike at 11 o'clock. It's people in that business and a lot of the more advanced industries like IBM Consulting, they already are there. Eventually, managers are going to realize command and control is not as important as productivity.
Hi. Yeah. The question is, have you thought much about the degree of de-urbanization if there were a major nuclear or biological attack against a major city?
Wow. Wow. That's a great question. Well, I think that one of the things that we know has happened is we know that the federal government is making the financial institutions not have everything in one place. Nobody wants to be the next, you know, not even talking about nuclear, I'm talking about terrorist attacks. Be very interesting what the effect is on, what's happening in London now, if that persists, whether some of the people in the city may want to disperse some of their operations. One of the cardinal principles of urbanism throughout history has been that people are in cities because they're safer than being in the countryside. And we may see an exact opposite in the future where people are in the countryside because it's safer than being in the city. I hope that doesn't take place, but we do know that after 9/11 there was movement of some financial activities. I think that the idea of the city being very vulnerable is a major issue, particularly also with people who have families.
Joel Kotkin follows global economic and social trends and has written for The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times, and The Wall Street Journal. His most recent book is The City, A Global History. If you missed part of Joel Kotkin's speech this hour, or if you would just like to hear it again, visit our website at wordforword.org. There you can hear this week's show, sign up for our free weekly podcast, and listen to any of our previous programs, including speeches by former President Bill Clinton, Fiasco author Thomas Ricks, and the Omnivore's Dilemma author Michael Pollan. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word for American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pancava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert and Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.